Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, and Kyle Mabry is at the controls this morning. And we're also very happy to have you back once again on the program, Mae Barenbaum. She is an entomologist, a scientist who specializes in studying insects. In fact, she is the head of the Department of Entomology at the U of I. And occasionally is here, and we talk about insects. And I always try to – now, we've done this sort of back-to-back here with her and Phil. Hate the bugs, love the bugs. I hope we've got all the extermination questions out of the way, because that's not what we do when May is here. That is not her thing. And Phil – and in all fairness, I want to say about Phil that he is also a guy that says he's a love-the-bugs kind of guy. And he says, okay, tell me what this problem is. And I really want to know, can you possibly live with this? If you can, maybe I can help you with that. If you got to get rid of it, okay. So, but we've done that now. And when May is here, we try to do something different. And we say, we'll try to appreciate insects for who and what they are. And if you have questions about insects, maybe it's something that you've seen and you're kind of wondering, what is this? Give us the best description you can, and May will see if she can tell you what it is. Other things we might talk a little bit about, you know, insects in the news, we can do that, that kind of thing. Those questions are welcome. 333-9455, that's for Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are welcome. Well, thanks very much.
Always a pleasure.
So I think one of the things you said you'd really like to talk about is a new opportunity for people who are, you know, in and around the campus of the University of Illinois to have some up-close and personal experience with some insects.
Yeah, we just opened a new, I guess you can call it a science discovery center, right on campus. It's on South Farms, and it's called the Pollinatarium. Not planetarium, but Pollinatarium, and it's all about the world of pollinators and the plants they pollinate. And building is a little off the beaten path, but it's very hard to miss because it's decorated with pictures of paintings of anatomically accurate butterflies and flies and moths and other and bats and hummingbirds and other pollinators. And inside is a whole array of exhibits featuring every kind of pollinator and all kinds of plants. We have an active beehive that you can actually watch as the bees work. And there's interactive exhibits for kids. And we're planning activities throughout the summer. And we'll start our regular hours on weekends, Saturday and Sunday, 1 to 4. And I think we'll kick off the programs on Sunday. The first Sunday, I think, is June 7th at 2 o'clock, we'll have Buzz the Giant Talking Bumblebee. Ventriloquist Hannah Skosky will be escorting Buzz the Giant Talking Bumblebee for kids to interact with. Mm-hmm. I have to warn you, he is a male bumblebee, and he really doesn't know very much about pollination because, of course, males have nothing to do with pollination, despite our society's insistence that male bees make good spokes in animals for products like Nasonex, which involves pollen allergies, which, of course, males have nothing to do with, or Honey Nut Cheerios. And, of course, the males have nothing to do with honey or the nuts. So what can you do? Our male-dominated society. So anyway, we're extend an open invitation. It's kind of a unique facility. I think it's the only freestanding center devoted to pollination anywhere in the country, and it's right here on our campus, and at least 30,000 insects to look at when you come to visit.
Very cool. All right. Well, and I have a couple of people here ready to go with questions. Others are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And we'll start out talking with someone in Indiana, Williamsport, Indiana. Line number two. Hello.
Hi, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question in regard to spiders that live in the soil. I have about 2 acres of pasture, and along my drive, I have about 5 feet of that pasture-type grass. And I have noticed that there are perfectly round holes, about, I would say, a centimeter in diameter, in the ground, and every time I walk by there, something moves. And so I'm horribly afraid of spiders, but I do let them live if they do not come into my house. So I look closer, and there seems to be a rather large brownish spider in there. And I do have pets, and I have a very my cat loves to hunt everything that moves, and I didn't know if that is anything that I need to be concerned about or...
Well, if it's nesting in the ground and it there's sort of a little opening and it's sort of a brown furry spider, odds are very good it's called a trapdoor spider. And the trapdoor spiders, the sort of archetypal spider spins a big web, but the trapdoor spider doesn't go for flying insects or aerial insects, goes for running creatures and basically sets a little trap, a little little flippy door that doesn't support weight. So it sort of hangs back in its burrow and then things that walk by fall in and get pounced on by the trapdoor spider. And to my knowledge, they're not – I mean, all spiders are venomous. That's how they make their living. They sink their fangs into – potential prey and inject the venom to help them manage sort of sedate the prey. That's not the group that's known for causing any problems with, unless there's an acute allergy or something, with pets. So they're kind of reclusive in the good way, not like a brown recluse is reclusive. They're not like aggressive. They don't come out and challenge you or anything. But the odds are good that – and it's fairly sizable, right? It's not a little tiny thing. How big is it?
I would think it's about at least an inch.
Yeah. Because the other kind of spider you find in the ground, they're called sheet webs, sometimes funnel web, but not the funnel webs that are deadly poisonous in Australia. That's the trouble with common names. Funnel webs or sheet webs – spiders kind of make a sticky flat web that extends for some distance, and they tend to be quite elongate, skinny, not very stout bodied, and so it really does sound like we probably have a trapdoor spiders rather than sheet webs.
I'm sorry, I had looked that up on the web, and I thought trapdoor. I don't see one, so I didn't think it was that. But you say they just wait for something to fall into that hole, and then there is a trap in there. Oh, it's okay. So the door itself is the trap, or that hole
itself is
the trap.
Yeah. Some of them actually do have a little lid, but others, it's just they hang back in a burrow. So.
Yeah, it hangs back in that burrow. I mean, it's at the entrance, sort of, and then when you look into it, it withdraws real fast.
Yeah, that's my guess. And I have to, the full disclosure here, I'm an entomologist and my spider cred is not nearly as good as my insect cred. So, but that to me is what it sounds like. Based on the size, where you find it, and its kind of behavior, that's what my guess would be.
Yes, I misunderstood the name of it then. Okay. Well, thank you very much. I've just been so curious because it's just... I've never seen it before, and now there are several holes, and it's been interesting. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
I'm going to have to bring my spider field guide next time I come on the air here.
Just to be perfectly accurate here, spiders are not insects.
Right.
So it's a whole separate area of study. Anything that's got six legs is an insect.
Or is related to something with six legs. Maggots have no legs, but they grow up to be flies that have six legs.
Right. Okay. Spiders have eight. Correct?
Right.
All right.
Yeah,
and then
there's
other things that have a jillion legs.
Right.
That's also another.
Millipedes, centipedes.
That's something else entirely.
And then the decapods of crustaceans like lobsters and shrimp and crabs and the like. So, I mean, I probably know a little more than the average person on the street.
Yeah.
But there's a million species of insects. It's a lot to keep track of. So.
All right. Well, if you have questions about one out of those million, give us a call, 333-9455 and toll free, 800-222-9455. Over to Belgium, line four. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. Once again. Ms. Barenbaum, I've listened to you about Fear Fest. And, I've talked to you many, many times about different things. But, I've never heard Mr. Inge ask you this question. And maybe it's not a good question to ask, but what animal scares you? What insect scares you the most? I think a botfly has got to be one of the most horrid things in the world. Maybe you have something worse.
Actually, it's pretty mundane, but I don't know if scared is the word, but I am exceedingly nervous about mosquitoes. Mm-hmm. Now, most people just kind of have hold them in contempt. But the thing about mosquitoes, bot flies, for those who don't know, the human bot fly is called Dermatobia hominis, and it lives in Central and South America. And the female bot fly hangs out in the forest, waits till a mosquito comes by, flies out, grabs a mosquito, and lays eggs on the mosquito. The mosquito then goes and seeks out a human host for a blood meal. The heat of the skin hatches the eggs on the underside of the abdomen of the mosquito, and the little maggots drop down to the skin surface and then find the hole that the mosquito mouth part's punctured and work their way in. And they live under the skin of humans. They form this sort of mass called a furuncle, which is kind of a separating, swollen sore. And they just live there with you. And they are truly creepy, although they do allow you to use the royal we because you are actually a host of something. And they presented a lot of they present a real problem in terms of treatment, because you don't squeeze them, because if they burst, then you end up with massive septicemia and blood poisoning. So the natives actually attract them by laying slabs of meat over the little air holes through which they breathe. There's a little opening at the top, and they stick their little air holes up there, and they'll hook their mouth hooks into it, and you can gently extricate them. But they can be surgically removed, or you can just let them develop, and ultimately they come out, pupate, and you're free of them. But the thing about mosquitoes is that they can infect you with incurable diseases, and you can't tell by looking at them which ones are the vectors. So that's where a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. And I don't look at every mosquito bite as just an annoying nuisance. I look at it as a potential case of West Nile virus or yellow fever or dengue or hemorrhagic fever or chikungunya virus or all kinds of other nasty things that mosquitoes are vectors of. So
I might suggest bot fly hurts so bad. Thank you very much.
Dying of malaria is no fun either. Although we haven't had malaria here in a long time.
All right. Well, if you're still listening, the number
this is
to call
for lunch, isn't it?
Yeah, really. 3-3-3-3-9-4-5-5, toll free 800-222-9455. I guess I'm now even, you know, I thought that about, well, I don't like mosquitoes. They're annoying and the bite's unpleasant, but I guess I didn't really think quite so much about, what is it? Encephalitis, I guess. That's just another one. I don't know. Have we actually seen West Nile here in Champaign County? Have we had cases of in a person with West Nile?
Well, certainly birds. And there may even have been mosquitoes that tested positive. I don't know about the human cases. Certainly in Chicago.
In Chicago,
area,
yes.
Yeah.
I know. That's true.
There's all kinds of mosquitoes. People often ask me, the one question I get all the time, what good are mosquitoes? And I have to say that there's an orchid in Colorado that's pollinated by mosquitoes. So the male mosquitoes are, here I am doing this gender stuff
again.
They're
the ones that don't bite.
They don't bite, and they visit flowers, and they even potentially can act as pollinators for rare and endangered orchids.
Yeah.
But
yeah, the other night I was out grilling in my backyard, and maybe I just picked the wrong time because it was sort of around dusk. Man, they were fierce. The only thing I could say is they were bats. They were having a good time.
Yeah.
They were flying around going after the mosquitoes. So I said, yay, go bats.
Go bats.
All right. Let's see. What are we doing here? We're going to talk next with someone in Champaign. Line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I had a question. We mistakenly made homes for bumblebees. We had a cottage 12 by 24, and my husband drilled holes for ventilation. He meant to get screens in them, but we got busy. Bumblebees started going up in there, and we decided just to leave them, you know, best thing to do. But winter came and went, and this spring, we didn't put any poison or anything in there, so I don't know what happened, but there were 16 to 18 adult bumblebees dead on the stairs of the cottage, which had fallen right out of the hole. Is that normal?
Actually, those probably are not bumblebees. Bumblebees nest in the ground.
What
you probably made.
Well, they look like yellow jackets, I mean.
They probably were carpenter bees, which look almost exactly like bumblebees, except they have naked abdomens. Bumblebees tend to have fuzzy abdomens, and carpenter bees have sort of black, shiny abdomens, at least the local most abundant species. And they love holes in wood. That's where they nest. They're not like bumblebees. They don't have these sort of colonies. They don't live in populations of a few hundred. It's just one female goes in and carves out tunnels. She doesn't eat the wood. She just chews the wood to get her way through it, makes little chambers, puts her eggs in there, and provisions the eggs with pollen, and then they hatch out. And why they would be dead...
thought it was the oddest thing. It was spring, and we were going to start cleaning up the yard, and we went onto the stairs of the cottage, and right where the hole where they had been going in the summer before, they had fallen, and they were like in the hens and chicks pot and on the steps and the porch right below the hole that went in.
Yeah, it sounds kind of like a catastrophic event because they do ultimately die of old age. They don't overwinter like only the queen bumblebees overwinter. And honeybee colonies, everybody can overwinter except the drones that get driven out of the colony. But it does sound like something sudden, like possibly, I don't know if there was a sudden freeze or something that might have accounted for their sudden mass death scene in front of the cottage.
It was the oddest thing, and we were all wondering what caused that because we never sprayed anything or anything.
It doesn't sound like a natural sort of thing. I mean, they do ultimately die, but not en masse, kind of like Jonestown or something. So
because we were counting them, and it was like 16 or 18.
Yeah. Poor
they
little
looked
bees.
Adult, and they were all over right below the hole.
Well, thank you though for making a home for them because a lot of people don't react quite so positively to them.
Well, my children will always say, Mom, I have a 12-year-old, and he'll always come out and go, Mom, there's a bee, but I have butterfly gardens.
That's great.
And so I always look at him and go, yeah, and your mother needs them, so
go. Good for you. That's great. That's great.
All right. But that was it. I was just wondering, what might have caused that.
The sudden death is a little mystifying, but they're almost certainly carpenter bees.
Okay, thank you very much.
Right.
Do they sting very often?
The males can't sting. The ones you see most often are males, and they're territorial, and they're curious. I call them curious. They will come out and kind of look you over. And females are capable of stinging, but you really, really have to provoke them. You have to like grab them in your hand, and I call them bad names or something. Really annoy them, and the stings are painful, but they're very, very reluctant to sting.
Okay, because this is like right in the entrance of the cottage.
Yeah. I would be very unlikely unless you accidentally stepped on one or something.
Okay, because we see them and they'll fly like right at our face.
Right.
And we just pause and then it will go on and we just go on about our business.
You want to have some low rent fun is when one of them flies by, if you throw a stone or something, it'll chase it. It's kind of,
oh, really?
Cheap thrills here. So. I always thought like Letterman's stupid pet tricks, this was stupid insect tricks. You know?
Okay.
So they're very very defensive. So if they see something, they'll go follow it. So
okay. Thank you very much.
Outdoor summer fun.
Thank you. Well, we had quite a few carpenter bee questions with Phil in the first hour because people are concerned because the carpenter bees will actually bore into the wood, and generally, you don't want them boring into your house. But I guess that also, if there was a hole there, it was just when it was available, they'd say, "Oh, great! I don't need to do the work. It's ready to move in."
Yeah, they if you provide them with prefab housing, they'll move right in.
All right. Well, okay. Let's see. Cell phone next, line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes. Go ahead.
First of all, I want to say, May, you're always scintillating, fun, keep it interesting. I like the sexual politics, and I like the sexiness in general.
My goodness. So,
don't change a thing. I had two questions about insects. Both vaguely similar. One, I was visiting a friend who lives at the M2 condo, and we don't see any bugs up on the ninth floor. And I was wondering, is there a limit to how high most bugs fly? question is, I play in a band a lot, and sometimes when we play outside in the summer, when we stop playing, all of a sudden, that's when we get bit. And I was wondering if birds are sort of moved by volume of music to sort of run like hell.
So, in sequence here, actually, there's not really a limit. In fact, there's a kind of spider that's called the high-rise spider that you find on like the 70th floor of high-rises and hotels in big cities. And it lives, I mean, it has to live on something. It actually lives on smaller invertebrates that get tossed around up at those heights. And there are lots of examples of samples that have been taken by airplane. And you can find insects and other, like, even wingless arthropods like mites up at 10,000 feet or more. They tend to get blown about once they get beyond the boundary layer. This is a sort of slow-moving air that by friction slows down right by the surface of the ground, where, you know, and it's slow enough they can control their movements. But if they launch themselves above the boundary layer, there's no telling how far they can go. And you can find wind-blown insects 200 miles out offshore on the middle of the ocean. I'm sure they're not that happy about being out there, but certainly in high-rises, you can find insects way high, way higher than the highest building in town here. In terms of musical preferences of biting flies, that's an intriguing question, because we do know that a lot of biting flies, particularly mosquitoes, are very sensitive to vibrations. That's how they find each other. Here we are entering the realm of sex and mating again. I don't know. You can't take me anywhere, can you? But certain frequencies are very attractive, and certain frequencies correspondingly are unattractive. So not a comment on the music of your band, but it may not be the right frequency for mosquitoes. But lest you think that they show discerning musical taste, periodically heavy machinery will get clogged with mosquitoes because it happens to hum at the right frequency. So they're not exactly, the Simon Cowells of the insect world.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. We are at our midpoint here. Our guest is May Barenboim. She's head of the Department of Entomology at U of I. She's a scientist who studies insects and is on the program here, particularly throughout the summer when insects are very active. We say, engage your curiosity. Save your extermination questions. We got a guy for that. He's already here, so you missed your opportunity. But if it's about something that you've seen and you're curious about it, you can give us a description. May, we'll see if she can tell you what it is and then maybe tell you some other things about it. So if you have more general kinds of curiosity questions about insects and how they live, that's what we do when she is on the program. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Our next caller is in Champaign, line 2.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
I wonder if you could give us a short primer on native bees, not necessarily bumblebees or carpenter bees, but the little short black bees that are, sometimes I think they're colonial and sometimes they're not. But we don't know very much about them, but you see them around on flowers a lot, and I think they do a lot of pollinating.
That's exactly right. And there's actually sometimes they look colonial and sometimes they don't, because sometimes they are and sometimes they aren't. There's actually way more bees than most people think there are. North America is a center for world bee diversity. We have about 4,000 species, and there's only like 49 of those that are bumblebees. So it's these sort of low-profile little bees that are hard even for entomologists sometimes to tell apart. The ones that seem to be colonial and probably aren't, they're there is a type of bee called a coleted bee, which is sometimes called a plasterer bee, what do they call them? Cellophane bees, because they can line their nests with kind of a cellophane-like material. And they tend to emerge in the spring in these big aggregations. And they're not interacting socially the way that the honeybee or the bumblebee, where everybody has a certain job and they're all related to each other. They're just kind of nesting in the same general vicinity of one another, but they do attract attention that way, and it's really kind of hard to tell exactly what they're doing. All bees are vegetarian. think that's without exception. They do like pollen and nectar, and they're important pollinators. And in fact, bumblebees and honeybees get a lot of the publicity, but some of the local bee family, there's all kinds of them. Halictid bees are called sweat bees. They tend to be, some of them are nest in groups, some of them nest individually. There's leafcutter bees, there's all kinds of bees. Are we still?
Can you get honey from colonies at all?
Well, the only bees that make honey are the ones that nest in these colonies in a true social, in a true society.
It's Italian.
And it's really hard to get honey in any quantity from around here from anything other than a honeybee. The bumblebee honey, they do make honey, but it kind of gets all mixed in with the pollen, and it's not easily separated. Around the world, there are other bees that are kept for honey, megacylids, leafcutter bees in the Yucatan. There's a long history of native megacyliculture raising these leafcutter bees for their honey. Trigonas, there's stingless bees around the world, or they're called sugar bag bees in Australia. There's some native bees that make honey. Otherwise, you'd be very disappointed if you dug into the nest of a halictid. All you'd find are little pollen balls, which probably wouldn't go over very well on your tea and toast. So,
okay. Thank you very much.
All right, sure. Thank you. Next person is in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi.
Sunday. I could have sworn, and now I'm wondering if I actually did, a very good-sized dragonfly. And then it occurred to me, you know, it's kind of early in the year for them. Was it? Could that have been possible?
Yeah, sure. Anything's possible with insects, because there are, you know, there's so many different species, and so many have different developmental requirements and timing and the like. Personally haven't seen any dragonflies yet, but that doesn't mean that they're not out there.
It was a big one, but then I thought, you know, maybe it was a hummingbird. But it looked, yeah, it had the fleeting glimpse of it I got of it. It looked like it had four wings and was buzzing around. Well, you know, it could have, I don't know, beats me. Second question, is it true mosquitoes do not like moving water? My local bird food purveyor. I have a bird sanctuary in my backyard. They have these things you can put in a bird bath. It keeps the water moving around, and supposedly it discourages mosquitoes from laying their eggs in it and stuff like that. Is that true, do you think?
Well, most of the pestiferous mosquito species do, in fact, prefer water that isn't moving too rapidly. So I don't know how fast the water is flowing in the bird bath, but they're not particularly strong swimmers. They don't have any way to anchor themselves. Black flies, for example, really like fast-moving, clean, aerated water. But they have a system for anchoring themselves when they're in their immature stages in the ground. Mosquito larvae, they're called wigglers. That's about the best they can do. They're not really swimmers. They're just sort of wigglers. And their pupal stage are called tumblers because they just sort of somersault around. They don't have much control over their movement. So a lot of them like still standing water, so you're far less likely to have mosquitoes colonize or take over your any body of water if it is moving, even slightly. So that's probably a good strategy.
Yeah, well, I've been warning about that. I rinse out the bird baths virtually on a daily basis anyway. So
that's good too.
Yeah, because the birds like fresh water anyway. So, and last question: what is the latest on colonies collapse? Disorders. And
couldn't have said it better myself.
Okay, thank you.
So
I wish people would not get buzzed and then call the show. It's, you know, never mind.
So the caller is referring to colony collapse disorder, this catastrophic, mysterious phenomenon that affected America's bees beginning in the spring of 2007, whereby the vast majority of the workers simply disappear, and what's left behind is an inviolable group of relatively young workers, the queen and the brood, the babies, along with pollen and nectar stores, honey stores. And it's still pretty much a mysterious phenomenon. Every couple of months, somebody comes up with new, quote, evidence of a possible explanation, but it's never the entire explanation. It never fits the epidemiology, the pattern of occurrence. The latest theory is that it's the neonicotinoids. That's been around for a long time. These are neurotoxic insecticides, relatively new, although they've been commercially used for the last 10 years. And they're suspected because they have sublethal effects on honeybees that may cause them to become disoriented and actually lose their memory. So they may just be lost, is why they're not coming back home. The trouble is, you know, here in central Illinois, we don't have any documented cases of colony collapse disorder, yet about 80% of the corn and soybeans planted in Illinois, in this part of Illinois, are probably treated with imidacloprid. So we should be ground zero for colony collapse disorder if, in fact, the neonics are the responsible. The good news, though, I'm sure there's a bee pun. I could work in on that, but give me a minute here. You'll be happy to know, whatever, that the Apiary Inspectors of America have been conducting a sort of controlled and regulated survey ever since this hit for the last few years. And the results of this year's survey are just about complete. And this is always done in concert with the enormous demand for honeybees in California almonds. Half of America's 2.4 million colonies of honeybees get transported to California just to pollinate the 660,000 acres of almonds that are growing there. So it's kind of a good time for a head count and assessment of the quality of the honeybee population. And the losses seem to be down. They were up upwards of 35% for the last 2 years, and they seem to be below 30% this year. So whatever it is may be abating. So that's the good news. And thank the caller for asking.
All right. Very good. We have other callers. Next, I think we'll talk with someone in Farmersburg, Indiana. Line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. Yes. I'm calling about what I think are fungus gnats.
Uh-huh.
And they seem every year to come around about early May to early June. I guess they feed on me while I'm walking, and I guess they feed for about a month. Is that about right? What kind of?
Well, I have to give points to Phil Nixon, before I come on, I always ask Phil, what has he been called about? Because he's the extension entomologist for the state,
yeah,
and always gets calls from people. And he said fungus gnats. So I don't know if they were covered in the first hour.
We did not talk about fungus
gnats. There you go. But he called it. So,
well, I'm interested in their life cycle, their mm-hmm. function in the ecology. I usually just clip on a couple of sheets of bounce on my hat, and it does deter them. It seems to, but
and they end up so soft and fluffy too.
Well, if they get through, I want to tell you, they make big welts on them.
Well, actually, fungus gnats, if that's what you have, don't feed on people. So
it must be another kind of gnat.
What it could be is a black fly, a simuliid, and
are they little tiny things?
They're tiny.
Ah,
and the fungus gnats, as the name suggests, they feed on fungus. They also can nibble on seedlings, plant seedlings and the like. And this is exactly the time of year for them. They breed in kind of wet soil. If they're in the house, it's from houseplants and the like. And they come out, and they're very flimsy-looking flies and relatively innocuous as adults. There's actually several families of flies are informally called fungus gnats. But if they're compact little sturdy flies that give you a big, nasty, really painful welt and a painful bite, then those are simuliids or black flies, sometimes called buffalo gnats.
Well, they are so small.
Yeah, they're very small.
Okay. Well, I'll be done. Yeah, so maybe I have both flying around me.
Yeah, the black flies will get you. And is it around your head and neck?
Yes.
Yep.
That's right. And the reason they were fungus gnats, I thought, well, they fly into my eyes, my nose, my ears.
Those are probably black flies.
Those are black
flies. They like that part of the body. And the thing about black flies, there's two types of biting flies in the world. There are the ones that have hypodermic syringe-like mouthparts, like mosquitoes, that use stealth. And they have anesthetizing substances, and they have anticoagulants, and they insert their needle-sharp proboscis so you don't even know you're being consumed. And Then they drink their fill and fly away. And then there are the other kinds, like the black flies, that have mouth parts that are like stilettos. And they don't have this elaborate anticoagulant stuff that keeps their blood, your blood from clotting. They don't have anesthetizing substances. So they are typically the they're called these pool feeders, they're called, tend to be very in your face and very hard to dissuade, and they punch a hole in you and lap up what they can and fly away, and are very resistant to you kind of trying to swat them away because they got one shot. That's what, you know, they don't sneak up on you. They are, you know, not shy about trying to feed.
Now, they seem to go away in about 30
yep.
days.
Yeah, that's it. They're typically spring. And I just actually read an essay, which I thought was fairly entertaining, to the effect of no good deed goes unrewarded. Black flies were for years not very common in this part of the country. Because
I didn't see them growing up.
Yep, because our water was so polluted. And black flies can only thrive in clean, fast-running streams and in moving water. So by cleaning up pollution and restoring streams to their more natural state, we also restored black flies. So you're right. Growing up, nobody ever saw these guys. And this is a sign of kind of the, I don't know, I guess it's a reward for those who are interested in insect diversity, but not so much a reward. They do leave a really nasty swelling. So.
The sheets of bounce do seem to deter them some. My older daughter told me about it, and I tried it, and sure enough, it does make a difference because I walk a lot. But now, are they the same as the black fly in the northern
yep.
north woods?
Well, the same family, certainly. Yeah.
But okay. All right. Yeah. Well, thanks for taking the time. I'm glad to find that out.
Yeah. Well, thanks right. for
Very
the question.
Good. Thank
okay.
you for the call.
Yep.
Others are welcome. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with May Barenbaum. She's head of the Department of Entomology at the U of I. And every once in a while she's here. We talk about insects. Again, we try to discourage the extermination stuff. We make that a separate show. This is more about trying to appreciate, coexist with insect life. 333-9455 and toll-free. 800-222-9455. Back here to someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yes. I have a question about a bee that's black and yellow and really about an inch long with very black legs, and they bore in the wood. And are these... carpenter bee?
That's almost assuredly a carpenter bee. You described it perfectly.
Okay, so I know you don't want to talk about extincting, getting rid of them, but the holes that they make, how far back do they go?
Well, it kind of depends on the species, but they can actually go back multiple inches, depending on how many... eggs that the female is going to lay. They tend to like to carve out moist wood or wood that's a little bit weathered or older. Is that where you're seeing them?
Yeah. Well, it's a soffit, or an overhanging roof.
Yeah, that's a popular location. So.
That is okay. Okay, I won't talk
well,
about...
Well, if you want to get rid of them, you can probably give Phil Nixon a call. Or did David
catch the
show
I'm
earlier?
Afraid I can do that for you. If what you want to do is you want to look for an insecticide called Seven, S-E-V-I-N.
Okay.
Use the dust. And what you want to do is put a little of that dust around the hole.
Around the hole.
Around
okay.
the hole. So what will happen is that the female bee going in and out of the hole will get this dust on the hair on her body, will groom it off, she will die. Then what you want to do, though, is just leave it alone, because if she has laid eggs in there, what you don't want to do, and I've heard Phil give this lecture a million times, what you don't want to do is caulk up the hole, because then what will happen is those eggs that she has laid in there will develop and mature, and if you've plugged up the hole, they'll just chew their way out. So you'll end up with not just one hole, you could end up with six holes. So
okay.
at the end, so in the fall, once the bees that are in there have matured, developed into adults, and flown away, then you can caulk up the hole. And the thing that he says is that they're attracted to raw, sort of raw wood surfaces. So the best way to try to protect that surface so they won't chew into it again is to paint it.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, thank you.
Well done, Dana.
Thank you very much.
Well, okay. All right. So the eggs will, the bees will fly away.
Yes, yeah. Yes, they'll fly. Once they, yes, once they,
they're done,
once they're done, once they mature and become adult bees, then they'll just fly. And if you leave leave that hole, they'll just go right out the hole that the female made. But that's why he says don't plug up that hole, because okay, they can chew their way out. They'll just chew it. They'll just chew themselves a new hole and we'll tunnel right out.
Right. Okay. Very good. Thank you.
All right.
We're going to have to get you a joint appointment in our department.
I don't think so. I've just, you know, there's certain things that I've heard the lecturer so many times I can do it myself now, but no, I would not claim to be practicing entomology. I'd be practicing without a license, and that would not be a good thing. Let's see. Next, we'll talk with somebody in Champaign County. Line 2. Hello.
Hi. Just broke the rule there. That's awful.
Oof. I know. Well, I'll take full responsibility.
Questions, I guess. I may have asked one of them, but maybe there's new research on it. You were evoking the image of this industrial pollination where the hives are shipped all across the country. Mm-hmm. Sounds like unsafe pollination practices to me, that if there is something, it would make the epidemiology vectors of transmission just impossible to keep track of, much less would accelerate.
Absolutely.
The problem quite a bit is anybody studying how much these practices have to do with colony collapse? And
that was an intense focus of early investigation. In fact, it's a trite phrase to say wake up call, but in fact, colony collapse disorder did bring attention to the fact that the beekeeping industry in the U.S. is alarmingly unimproved, considering it's worth about $19 billion. Honeybees are still living in essentially 19th century housing. They're living in Langstroth hives, which were designed in 1850. And about the biggest innovations in technology in commercial apiculture are rubber tires on the trucks that are used to transport them 1,000 miles to California. So people did think that maybe this practice of trucking them across the country and then restricting them to a single food item for weeks at a time. And that's what happens. The migratory beekeepers take their bees to California for almonds, then up to Montana for clover, and then in Florida they go up for blueberries. So it's not the kind of gleaning behavior that the honeybee probably evolved with. They are capable of feeding on hundreds of different flowers, and they're not really designed to feed on only a single food. So there's been a number of investigations trying to determine the effect of this transport on behavior, on the effect of a very monotonous diet on general health and well-being. And there are effects, but none of them map on to colony collapse disorder. In fact, a lot of hobby beekeepers that have only a few hives in their backyard experience this phenomenon as well. And the reason it attracted a lot of attention among the commercial beekeepers is they have most of America's bees. So they experienced most of the losses. But proportionately, even organic beekeepers who are very attentive to the needs of their bees experience these losses. So it really does point to more to a disease phenomenon than to just poor management unhealthy management. That said, if you bring 1.2 million bees into California, you're setting conditions up for an epidemic. So you're absolutely right about that.
Even the organic people are going to have bees that are going to share a flower with them.
Yep.
With another bee. So.
Oh, and you know what's even more alarming is they found Israeli acute paralysis virus, which was a new virus that was discovered as a consequence of this new metagenomic investigation that was facilitated by the honeybee genome, was used right after colony collapse disorder. This virus actually shows up on pollen in flowers in the field. So species-to-species transmission is a possibility, and that was something no one suspected before. So,
right. Yeah. Well, it seems to me that during the lead up to the stimulus package, there was some lampooning of some money put in for.
Don't get me started on that. What incredible! I mean, here's the political rant here. $1.7 million for the Weslaco quote honeybee factory. That was number 10 on the 10 porkiest projects on John McCain's Twitter. Okay, the $1.7 million was actually the not stimulus money, not even technically omnibus spending bill money. That was the line item, the line budget item to maintain that facility. It's not pork. It's not for Texas bees. It's for the world's bees. It's for the entire nation's bees. And it's just its regular operating budget. Mitch McConnell and Bitter from Louisiana also belittled that, made fun of that, yet they had voted for it twice in previous legislation. It's just because it's a, I don't want to call it a soundbite, it's an unsoundbite. It is politically correct to make fun of insects, and I don't understand why, because this particular insect is responsible for the production of 90 crops in North America. And, you know, we just came off this crisis, and there's, for the first time ever in the Farm Bill, these same people inserted language to support research on bees, and here they, with their other hand, they're taking it away. So I hope I haven't offended anybody out there, but to me, this was just astonishing. It was just kind of a cheap shot, really picking on bees. You know, come on.
Well, given the possibility of a widespread die out or something, it seems that there would be someone thinking ahead would say, well, let's go to a district based bee system and not ship bees all across the country and spread something that might take out, you know, a lot of the crops. So anyway, I don't want to get you apoplectic or anything, so why don't we change the subject here? And I think I might have asked you about right-handed and left-handed sugars before. Tupelo honey supposedly has 70% L-glucose or dextrose.
Dextrose, yeah. Oh, dextrose is the right.
Oh, that's it, right. Yeah. It would be sinistrose if
right.
it were. But anyway, Are people studying anything about that and whether bees select depending on, you know, what their druthers are?
Interesting you should
say
that.
I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
There, in fact, Roy Barker, who was a graduate student here in the 50s, went on to be a bee biologist, and he found that there are actually some sugars that are poisonous to bees. And bees tend to cope with these well because they glean. They rarely get all of their sugars from a single floral source. Here at the University of Illinois, one thing that we recently discovered is honeybees have enzymes that break down poisons such as pesticides, and they're also used for processing some of the plant constituents that are found in nectar. Nectar's full of, it's not just sugar water, it's full of all kinds of plant chemicals. And when you concentrate nectar down, like honeybees do when they make honey, then these biologically active materials are present in higher concentrations. Well, one thing we found, my graduate student Reed Johnson inadvertently discovered that if you feed them honey, you activate these detoxification enzymes. If you feed them sugar, and by extension, probably high fructose corn syrup, which is what many beekeepers use to get their bees through the winter, those enzymes don't get cranked up. So bees are really, really tuned to feeding on honey, which should not be a surprise to anybody because that's why they call them honeybees. But, you know, beekeeping practice, honey is expensive. Bees are fed sugar water during the winter. They have beekeepers have gone to feeding high fructose corn syrup. And it's not outright toxic. In fact, Roy Barker did some of that work in the early 70s. But you have to keep in mind that not all sugars, as you say, not all sugars are equally digestible or equally healthy.
All
even
right.
For honeybee.
We'll try to get at least one more. Williamsport, Indiana. Line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have some small white flies that attack a poinsettia or live with a poinsettia that I've had in the house. And when I tried to get rid of the little white flies with some 7 insecticide, the flower dried up. Anything you can help me with to get rid of the white flies without damaging the flower?
Well, that's actually, again, not my department. What we do in white flies, when we have white flies in our greenhouse, actually, is you can get biological control agents. There are wasps that live only on white flies. They parasitize the white flies, and you can order these from all kinds of garden supply type outfits. And at least in our greenhouse, they do quite a decent job, and they have nothing to do with the flowers. They, you know, don't go anywhere. They may sip a little nectar, but they certainly aren't damaging. So that's how we deal with the white flies, is we just buy these little tiny wasps. They come on what you get are little yellow cards that have the mummies of white flies, so the bodies that have housed these wasps, and the wasps will come out and seek out the white flies in your house and take care of them. Again, I'm not an extension entomologist, but I can tell you that's what we do to avoid using any chemicals.
All right, I will look for that solution.
All right. Otherwise, probably go to your whatever's local garden center. I'm sure that there are extension folks in the state of Indiana that whose job it is that could help you out
to
with questions
like that.
To hook
you up like with that. Some parasitic wasps.
All right. And just one more time, again, you talked back at the beginning of the program about your pollinators. Your
pollinatarium. Yeah. If you're going east on Lincoln past Windsor, is the first left, 606 West Windsor. And it's will be open weekends, Saturdays and Sundays, 1 to 4. All kinds of interactive exhibits for kids. There are displays for grown-ups. There's a real live bee hive, busy as bees are wont to be. And on starting in June, we'll have activities on Sundays, too, for visitors.
Mae Barenbaum, she's head of the Department of Entomology at the U of I here in Urbana-Champaign. Look for her books at a bookstore near you.
And a new one coming out in August.
And the title?
The Earwig's Tale, a modern bestiary of multi-legged legends.
And who's the publisher?
Harvard University.
All right. Thank you very much. We'll see you again, maybe a little later in summer.
You bet.